This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us on Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast that will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. Now, in each podcast episode, you have been hearing a story about conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and the lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Many of the details of the story you're about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation, while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Well, today we are very, very blessed to have Steve Ahern, who I have gotten to know over the past few weeks, it's absolutely clear to me why people like to use Steve for mediation. He is a very knowledgeable and experienced mediator. He has also a great deal of experience in his legal career, which actually, you know something, I'm going to let Steve expand on that and on his mediation.
Good morning, Len. Thank you for having me on. I've been with ADR Services now for only about 8 months doing mediation, as full-time as I am able to do. Prior to that, I was an insurance defense attorney for my entire legal career. I had been a tradesman for about a decade before deciding to go to law school. And while in law school, I answered an advertisement for a position at an insurance defense firm in Oakland. It was then called Vandepoel, Strickland, and Hopple. I hit it off with the hiring attorney and was hired as a law clerk. They supported me while I studied and took the bar exam, then offered me a position as an associate. After a few years, offered me a position as a partner. And after a few more years, through the attrition of the senior partners, I became the managing partner of the firm and did that for the last 10 years of my career. But my entire career was insurance defense, well, all of which was dealing with personal lines, claims, and policies, and 80% of which were under reservation of rights.
So your background dealt with a number of substantive areas, I know, and everything from real estate to personal injury to public entity disputes. But today we're going to be going into an area of landlord-tenant and some dispute that arose out of that. Steve, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, just a bit more background on the landlord-tenant. The way things used to work, the carriers would have local claims units, and on these personal lines policies that were under reservation of rights, they were highly sophisticated claims units and highly focused. I was fortunate enough back in about 2005 to have one of the carriers approach me and ask that we be their exclusive firm for handling of landlord-tenant cases, housing cases. So the last 10 years of my, no, 20 years of my career, focused heavily, maybe 80% on those cases.
So this particular dispute that you're about to convey to us, was that the usual kind of dispute, or how did this fit into the mix?
Right. Well, so the dispute concerned, it was a landlord-tenant dispute, and it concerned a four-unit building in Oakland. And the plaintiff was a young woman who had lived in her unit on the top floor of the building for 20 years. She had moved in with her parents as a child, and her parents had since moved away, and she was alone now in the unit as the tenant. She had a very favorable rent, which is why she stayed there. Because, as you know, it's very expensive to live in the Bay Area. So that certainly made her life a lot easier. The claim, it was typical. I mean, there were some things about it, just like every claim, that were unique. But it was a pretty typical claim. It'll be apparent quickly why. And for the most part, it was because all of the people who were involved in the dispute were ignorant of the law. That's typically the problem. They're ignorant of the law, and so they get into trouble. So I want to just give a brief context here. So in Oakland is an environment in which there are very aggressive tenant protection laws, similar to San Francisco, to Berkeley, to Los Angeles. But Oakland is a working class city, and it was at the forefront of the tenant protection movement, I should say. And it's a very tenant-friendly jurisdiction. In the rent ordinance, there's a tenant protection ordinance, a subsection that's tenant protection ordinance. And it makes it unlawful to do many things. It has a bad faith requirement, but it makes it unlawful, for example, to fail to exercise due diligence in completing repairs. It makes it unlawful to fail to follow appropriate industry remediation protocols, especially when it comes to things like mold and other contaminants. It makes it unlawful to attempt to influence a tenant to vacate a unit involuntarily through fraud, intimidation, coercion. It makes it unlawful to threaten a tenant or their guest by word or gesture or physical harm, among many other things. The remedies under the ordinance are onerous. It's treble damages and attorney's fees. There's also a relocation ordinance in Oakland, and it requires relocation payments be made to a tenant when that tenant is displaced. And it similarly carries onerous penalties. And suffice to say, in this dispute, all of the participants were ignorant of those laws when the events unfolded.
Wow. So ignorant of it to the point of the dispute itself arising. And what was the dispute?
Well, plaintiff, like you said, had been a resident for 20 years. And her landlords for all of that time were the Abbotts. They had owned the building for, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. They were older people. And they were very sophisticated and experienced landlords. In November of 2021, they sold the building to the Bennetts. The Bennetts were a family, elderly parents and their two adult sons. And this was a joint investment for them. And it was the first time that they had bought real property. And it was the first time that they had bought investment property. In so doing, they overextended themselves financially and left themselves very little margin for unanticipated costs. And they certainly weren't prepared to face unanticipated liabilities such as were extant then in Oakland. So in preparation for the sale, the Abbotts the sellers obtained a roof inspection, which recommended that the roof, which was, I don't know, 25 years old, be replaced. The Abbotts disclosed that report to the buyers, the Bennetts. But neither the Abbotts nor the Bennetts did anything during the escrow period to correct the condition. It wasn't clear to me whether there had been a credit given or what, but in any event, the building passed with a faulty roof. Less than a month after the escrow closed, there was a large rainstorm here, and so much water leaked through the roof that the ceiling in the plaintiff's bedroom collapsed onto her bed, and the whole apartment was soaked. And, you know, as a result, she had to move out right away. Now, as the new landlords, the Bennetts had hired a property management company because they didn't feel that they were capable of managing the property themselves. Unbeknownst to them, the property management company had an employee, we'll call him Carlos, who was a bit of a loose cannon. So the Bennetts undertook repairs, you know, with reasonable diligence. They went slowly because it was, you know, the height of COVID, and it was the holidays, and it was still raining out, and there was just a lot of things. But they did move with reasonable alacrity to get the repairs made. You know, it took about a month, and after plaintiff had been displaced for several weeks, she demanded $20,000 in compensation for her expenses and inconvenience. And she passed that along to Carlos. And in relaying that demand to the Bennetts, Carlos characterized it as nefarious. He called it blackmail, when in fact it was justified under the relocation ordinance. Once the repairs were completed, the plaintiff advised the Bennetts that she was asthmatic, and she asked them to replace the carpet and to have mold testing done in the unit before she would move back in, because it was a particular sensitivity of hers. You know, she relayed that to Carlos, and Carlos told her that the landlords wouldn't do any of that. It wasn't even clear to me whether Carlos had relayed that demand to the landlords. He just took it upon himself to become very aggressive with her. And he met in person with her, and this was really the heart of the dispute. He met in person with her, and she recorded the meeting. And in the meeting, he threatened her physically and with eviction. He said, "I'm going to kick you out." And he said, and this was a quote because it was a transcript, "And you'll see who will come to your door and knock, and later you'll see who comes, because you don't know who I know." Well, that pretty much put an end to the tenancy. During the following week, even though she was still displaced, the tenant got her own mold inspection, but she didn't provide it to the landlord. She returned the keys a few days later, having never reoccupied the unit. Then she sued both the Bennetts, her current landlords, and the Abbotts, the prior landlords. The claim against the Abbotts was for breach of the warranty of habitability. She said there had been leaks while they owned it. The claim against the Bennetts sounded in the rent ordinance, treble damages, attorney's fees. The Bennetts cross-complained against the Abbotts for non-disclosure.
So that sets up the dispute, and we are going to take a break. I'm chatting with Steve Aber on Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and we'll be back in a moment.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Steve Aber, who is telling us a story of a tenant who terminated the tenancy. I suppose that's the right characterization, but the reasons behind it are really the important things that led to the dispute. And Steve, what was your first level of knowledge with respect to this dispute? What did you know, and how did you know it?
The landlord-tenant bar in the Bay Area is small. It's, you know, 50 people. And we all know one another, and many of us have known one another for many years. It's a mature, experienced bar. And especially the plaintiff's bar, because it's a very lucrative area, you know, with the attorney's fees and, you know, basically having guns to the head of the heads of the landlords. So the plaintiff's attorney in this case was a fellow who I'd known for 25 years. And we'd had our ups and downs as adversaries in several disputes. But this one he sent to me to try me out as mediator. I did have a pre-mediation discussion with him, but he was the only one of the lawyers who answered my call for my invitation for a pre-mediation conference. So he told me the basic outline.
Okay.
And I went into it understanding that, you know, the big things here were, you know, the loss of the unit due to the fear of asthma and the coercion by this Carlos.
And was he forthcoming that he had the recording, or is that something that he was going to hold back and spring later?
No, I didn't learn about the recording until the mediation session. Okay. And I asked him during the mediation to provide it to me, and he provided it to me on a confidential basis. And once I read it, the transcript, you know, I got him to agree that I could share it with the defendants, because the Bennetts had been unaware of this interaction. They were only just learning about it. And I wanted them, and particularly the claims representative, to hear what Carlos had said, because it was an overt threat of physical violence, and you know, it was crucial that they understood that there was going to be liability under the tenant protection ordinance.
And was the adjuster an out-of-state adjuster or somebody that had to be educated to the Oakland ordinances, or somebody who was well familiar with it?
Well, no, it was the former. So as I was saying earlier, you know, it used to be the case that admitted insurance carriers, the bigger ones, would have local claims units. And for these sort of personal lines claims, they would have a small cadre of very experienced claims reps who, you know, knew the lawyers, knew the judges, knew the law. And, you know, those were sort of the golden days. In the last few years, there's been a shift in the insurance industry of centralization of claims. So, you know, in the latter part of my career, I'd often be dealing with claims reps from the East Coast, who had no idea of, you know, the law or any of that. And that was the case here. The claims rep in this case was living in Texas. She was very conservative. And she had no idea. I mean, I'm sure that the defense attorney had evaluated the case and had told her about the tenant protection ordinance and the relocation ordinance, but she really didn't have a visceral or experiential understanding of what that meant.
And so one of the tasks that are facing you is to provide, an injection of the reality of the situation?
Absolutely. And the curve is not steep. I got a lot of pushback. And, you know, the claims rep was outraged, really. I mean, she was outraged by Carlos's behavior, but she was outraged also at the damages, right? The treble damages and attorney's fees. It really is a very aggressive statutory scheme that has the landlord at a very distinct disadvantage. And that she found to be just hard to swallow.
In that minute that it took her, did she have any realization as to whether there were coverage issues about those ordinance damages?
Well, she came to the mediation loaded for bear on the coverage issues. These personal lines policies, which this was one, even when they have personal injury damages, not bodily injury, but personal injury, wrongful eviction, invasion of right to occupancy, those sorts of things, they have so many exclusions that they really don't cover the sorts of liabilities that Bay Area landlords face. They don't cover the statutory penalties. They don't cover violations of law. I mean, just on and on. They don't cover mold, of course. So she came loaded for bear with all of her coverage reservations and was very intent on getting a contribution from the Bennetts. But it was, dawning on her at the mediation just exactly what the scale of the damages that they were facing. Fortunately, and it's not always the case, but fortunately, this policy had a supplementary payments provision. A supplementary payments provision is one that says we pay costs taxed against the insureds. And costs include attorney's fees. Now, carriers are getting wise to that and are now writing policies that say we pay costs taxed against the insured except attorney's fees. But this policy didn't have that exception. So no matter what the coverage reservations were on the indemnity provisions of the policy, there was this exposure for attorney's fees that was not subject to coverage limits or just the policy limits.
Now, was this issue something that the plaintiff's attorney was advocating or something that you picked up?
It was something that I picked up. I find that the tenant attorneys sometimes are familiar with coverage, but for the most part, they're not. So one of the first questions I ask of the defense is whether there's a supplementary payments provision, because that's a big stick to use to influence, their contribution towards a settlement. Sometimes I'm provided a copy of the policy and I'll look for myself, but here I had to ask, and the claims rep acknowledged that there was a provision.
That is a key piece of information, it would seem, because it would bear on the risk that the Bennetts would have, correct?
Well, it bore on the risk, yes. It bore primarily on the risk that the carrier had.
Correct. Okay.
A liability that is not so sensitive to the merits of the case. Plaintiff gets a dollar and she gets her fees. And it's not subject to policy limits. So if you had a policy with $300,000 limits, and the attorney's fees were $500,000, the carrier's on the hook.
So the contribution argument that the claims adjuster was loaded with coming in was somewhat diffused by this knowledge?
Absolutely. She had a weak position on asking for a contribution. And, moreover, it was the fact that the Bennetts were overextended. They didn't have the ability to make a contribution, at least a significant contribution. They did in the end make one. And in fact, it took me weeks to get that squared away. So, I came to the end of the mediation, and because everybody was so off balance from learning about this meeting with Carlos and learning about some of the damages issues, I had to make a mediator's proposal. The plaintiff accepted the proposal. The Abbotts, the sellers, accepted the proposal relatively quickly. They were, again, sophisticated people. They knew what they wanted to pay, and they paid it. It took several weeks for the Bennetts, through their personal counsel and the carrier, to negotiate between them what the contribution would be, and also several weeks for the claims rep. I say the claims rep, but that's a little bit of a misnomer. The claims rep isn't an individual. I mean, in participating in the mediation, it's an individual, but all the claims reps have supervisors, and the supervisors have supervisors, and, it's just a very rationalized process that they go through. So all of this, basically new information took a while to be digested by the the insurance bureaucracy in this company in a few weeks.
Educating an insurance company on things like this sometimes is akin to trying to turn the Titanic before the iceberg is hit. Right. And it seems. And this case doesn't dispel that notion. So, before we get to the mediator's proposal, how did the day progress? Did you have more than one session, or was it just the one session and then follow-ups?
Well, it was just the one session and follow-ups. I like to work quickly, and especially the professionals, but people's time is valuable and they don't like to screw around. So we get right down to it. And, you know, most of the time, you know, usually I like to spend little time in the merits because folks are generally pretty familiar with the facts and they understand the merits pretty well. In this case, there had to be a lot of time focusing on the merits. And, you know, again, everybody wrapping their mind around this meeting with Carlos. And so I was able during the meeting to get some idea where at least the Abbotts were and where the plaintiff was. And that informed my ability to make a mediator's proposal that I thought would have a reasonable chance for succeeding.
We are going to be getting into the wrapping up of the mediation and reaching a resolution and some takeaways. When we get back, I'm Len Levy. We're on Masters of Dispute Resolution, and we're going to take a short break and then continue our conversation with Steve Abert.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Steve Abern. Steve has already conveyed the essence of what was taking place at the mediation, but one of the things that we went into, or Steve went into, was the creation of the mediator's proposal, which essentially is what Steve figures might get this case settled. And I'm going to let Steve get into whether there's an emotional component to this mediator's proposal that had to be factored in and what other things were factored into creating that proposal.
Yeah, so during the mediation, I tend to rehearse the various numbers with the attorneys. I was trying to condition, or at least explore whether, trying to condition the plaintiff to a number in the threes, which was about half the value of the claim on a good day. And, you know, trying to gauge whether that was something that she may be amenable to hearing as a proposal. The Abbotts, I was very explicit with them about the kind of amount that I would put into a mediator's proposal because, again, they were sophisticated people. They came to the mediation knowing what they wanted to pay, and they stuck to their guns. With the carrier and the Bennetts, it was a different matter. I suggested numbers simply to condition the carrier. here was a little bit of a problem. So the defense attorney wanted me in my proposal to assign for the Bennett's contribution, to assign a contribution to the carrier and a contribution to the Bennett's personally. And I didn't want to do that. I thought that was going to only lead to problems. So I just put a single number for the Bennett's and left it to their personal counsel and the claims people to negotiate between themselves.
To do otherwise would have been a completely separate mediation.
Right.
Okay. So you get the mediator's proposal out there. You give them a certain amount of time to respond, taking into account the fact that the ship has to be turned very slowly on the insurance company end. And so were there any attempts to communicate in either direction while that proposal was pending?
Oh, yeah. So I gave the parties 10 days to respond. Again, the plaintiff and the Abbotts responded quickly. The Bennett's, when we came to the end of the 10 days, they asked for a week extension. And when we came to the end of that week, they asked for another extension. So it turned out to be 25 days or more that this proposal was pending. And during that time, I was emailing, calling, and texting both the Bennett's personal counsel and the insurance defense counsel, trying to see what can I do to help to, interject myself into the negotiations. What do you need? What do you need? That kind of thing.
And were those communications, in essence, were like a separate mediation?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's the lesson, the first lesson I learned, too, is you just don't let go. I mean, you're a hired man for a few hours, but not really. If the case isn't resolved after those few hours, you just keep with it. And I think it's good mediation practice to just do it at no additional charge. Just stick with it. You're hired to resolve a dispute. Just do that.
Right. And that requires a certain amount of tenacity and a certain amount of ability to say, something, my goal is to help these parties reach a deal. And if that's what it takes, that's what I'm going to do.
Yes.
Right. So there was an emotional element to this, though, and I'm not sure we really fully explored what emotions were impeding the settlement in this case, if any.
Well, it's the reason I chose this mediation to talk about was because the emotional component was so predominant. I mean, it's axiomatic that every mediation has an emotional component. In this one, I mean, the plaintiff was a young single woman. She was losing the home that she had grown up in, and she had been threatened with physical violence by this Carlos. So she was very upset by that. And in the mediation, she was having to reconfront all of that. The Bennett's, for their part, I mean, they were learning about what had occurred in that meeting with Carlos, and they were dismayed and they were embarrassed. And they were really upset that they had to essentially buy that, even though they had never heard of the guy, because he was technically their agent. They were surprised by the magnitude of the damages. They were surprised by the realities of the carrier's position on coverage. And they were concerned that they would lose the property because they had overextended financially to buy this place in the first place. I try to be, to practice empathy in mediation. I think it's important. So I always endeavor, when there is an emotional component that's becomes a factor, to acknowledge people's feelings. And it doesn't have to be a big deal. You don't have to be their psychotherapist or anything, but I think it is important to say, I understand what you're feeling. Invite them to tell you how they're feeling. Say, I understand how you feel. That's valid. I'd feel the same. I mean, it can only just be a few sentences, but it goes a long way when people feel that they're being acknowledged on a human level, as opposed to, you know, negotiators in a negotiation.
Now, this particular mediation did not involve a professional liability policy. There's no real consent that needs to take place with respect to the Bennetts as a policy matter. But in a sense, it seems like there had to be an agreement reached between the Bennetts and their carrier, which might be something akin to consent.
Well, they did have to come to agreement on what the Bennetts' contribution was going to be. And it, you know, the carrier started out asking for a much larger contribution than they eventually were able to obtain. And so, you know, I worked a lot with the insurance defense counsel to help her articulate to the carrier the carrier's exposure, because, you know, they were having to switch gears, you know, to put more money on the file than ever they thought was going to be required to settle the case. And there was an interesting piece there, too, because the insurance defense attorney was, you know, very, very ethical, and she felt very constrained to discuss coverage or personal contribution with the carrier. And so that's where I came in, because I'm not, as the mediator, I wasn't limited by those constraints.
Well, you know, to me, it sounds that your background in insurance may have been an absolute key here to getting this resolved, because the elements that they thought going into it led to them being far apart, but they weren't aware of coverage issues. They weren't aware of the practical issues of the ordinance. It seems that there was a lot of educating that needed to be done, and you're in the unique position to do it.
Absolutely. And that's exactly how I market myself. If you look at ADR's website, you know, having done this for so many years, I know just how to deal with the insurance carriers, who are arguably the most important players in a mediation, because they're funding the settlement. I mean, it's one thing to ask for money, it's another to fund it.
One of the things that you alluded to earlier, and I think you said you're not dealing with an individual. In a sense, you are. In a sense, you're not. Because that individual, the insurance adjuster, has to answer to a person who has to answer to somebody else. And so the idea of their interest being, I don't want this to come back to bite me. I need to make a decision that is credible and is not going to be is not going to make people above me think this person just gives away money or something along those lines, right?
That's exactly correct. And, you know, and one thing I learned early on in my career, and you know, it may be people may disagree with this, but I think it's true, is that it doesn't really matter to the insurance company how much they pay on claims like this. I mean, big claims that, you know, of millions of dollars is another thing. But these claims that are in the six figures, it doesn't really matter to them how much they pay. What matters is that everybody in the chain of decision has cover, so because they answer to somebody above them. And so as insurance defense counsel, I always provide rationale to give them cover, and I still do that as a mediator. Here's why you're justified in paying this money, because you have, in this case, you have exposure on the supplemental payments provision that isn't limited by the policy limits. You need to manage that risk.
Is there anything else that occurs to you that anybody could have done going into this mediation to better prepare or do something that would have enhanced the ability to reach a resolution?
I regret that I didn't have more extensive pre-mediation discussions with the attorneys. I mean, my discussion with the plaintiff's attorney was probably 30 minutes, but he wasn't familiar with all the insurance stuff. And he didn't reveal to me the business about the meeting with Carlos in our initial meeting. I would certainly have loved to have a meeting with the defense attorney prior to the mediation so that I could understand where the coverage was and ask her to start to precondition the carrier about the risks. But she's a busy woman, and she didn't have time to have that meeting, and so we took care of those issues in the mediation session.
Unfortunately, we are out of time because I thoroughly enjoyed this discussion and you're conveying the takeaways that I think will be beneficial to parties who participate in this type of mediation. If people want to contact you to perhaps book you for a mediation or just contact you generally, what's the best way to do that?
Well, through ADR Services. I have a case management team, but you can always reach me at SABERN@ADRServices.com.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's absolutely been a real, real pleasure having this conversation. I hope we can do it again in the future. And as we wrap up, I thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs, Inc. I hope you continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.